This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast.
Hello there and welcome to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, the very best bits of today's show from the 13th of July. It is a Wednesday. So what have we got for you today? Well, you're going to enjoy the interview with Dr. Nasser Saeedi talking about Joe Biden's visit to the Middle East. Nasser Saeedi is in Beirut. Joe Biden is in Israel and heading to the West Bank. We're getting Nasser's take on what it means for the UAE economy, Israel, the West Bank, the Palestinian economy, and of course his home country, Lebanon, because Dr. Nasser is a former economy minister in Lebanon. Then we're talking about aviation because Heathrow Airport has said it's going to cap the number of flights this summer. One of a number of challenges that European airports are facing. What does it mean for travellers here in the UAE? Going to hear from the aviation lawyer, Nick Humphrey of the law firm Kennedy's. And finally, staying with the travel story, Eurodollar is almost, effectively, it is at parity now. Lord, that is great for you if you're going on holiday to Spain or Italy this summer, because your dirham's going to go further. It'll buy you more paella or more espressos on the streets of Milano. But for German tourists and European tourists booking holidays here in Dubai in the peak winter months, it's not great for our hotels because it makes us much more expensive to Frau und Herr Schmidt from Dusseldorf. So we thought, well, let's get a German hospitality expert to shed some light on this. Siegfried Nierhaus is the head of Deutsche Hospitality, known for brands including Steigenberger. Get his thoughts on what it means for the UAE hotel industry. All that to come. First up, though, let's dive into a couple of today's big business stories, Twitter and Vijay Mallya. Flicking through the international newspapers, first of all. Shruti Rajendran, you've picked up on Elon Musk and Twitter.
Yes. So Elon has now decided that he will not be buying Twitter. And Twitter, in return, have decided that they will take him to court to force him to buy the social media firm. And I read this analysis that said it was like a marriage that nobody wanted to walk down the aisle. But now Twitter is forcing Musk to walk down the aisle, and either they will get him to pay out and say, OK, we'll leave you alone, just pay us this sum, or it will lead to Elon winning, which would not bode well for Twitter, because that would mean losing face. And it all started because first Elon said he will buy Twitter. Then he said that he was unhappy with their bots and their the fake accounts. And he said that, you know, there's not enough information about it. And then he announced that he was walking away from it. So yeah, in contract terms, not very solid for Elon, I think.
If you're a lawyer, though, it's a good day for you. And it has been for a wee while. Does this work? No, I think at any point that you've got legislation to try and get people to do stuff, particularly a merger and things like that. Well, it's not a merger, but it is. It's a merger of Twitter and Elon Musk, isn't it? I mean, I think the best case scenario for Twitter is that they get more than the billion breakup fee, the prenup that has been signed between Elon and Twitter, to take your marriage analogy a little bit further. That's the best case for Twitter, isn't it? They get a solid for their shareholders. They get more money than a billion, but they don't get sold to a grumpy man who just really wants to go to space.
Well, the best case scenario for Twitter is that they enforce the law called special performance and make Elon buy the company and force him through. And I was looking at some legal analysis, and it's rarely enforced, but a Delaware court can do that. They can make you go ahead with the deal that you said you would do. There is legal precedent for that. It's rare, but it can be done. So the best case for if you're a Twitter shareholder is that you get the full $44 billion. Elon ends up owning Twitter. It's an absolute disaster, of course, because like you say, it's a marriage that nobody wants.
Yeah, but you're looking
you get
at
the money.
But you're looking at what's good for the shareholders. I would argue that the reason Twitter exists is not just to make profit for its shareholders. Shareholders are there to allow Twitter to exist, not the other way around.
Yeah. I take your point, but you know, if you've got Twitter in your pension fund, and you were thinking,
yeah, oh, we've lost the plot on this. We have absolutely lost the plot on what we think shareholders and buying shares in a company and owning a bit of a company, for goodness sakes, is for. Twitter exists. It goes public so that it can raise more money to do more stuff. That's the point of having shareholders. It's not so that you can spend the rest of your life pleasing them. And by the way, I'm with Elon on that. And the reason that he takes public companies private is because he says you end up in this horrendous rut, and I'm paraphrasing, where you're just living to please the shareholders on a quarter to quarter to quarter basis. It stops any sort of long-term planning, big sky thinking and all the rest of it, because everyone's just looking at your, you know, if your Pepsi quarterly earnings about what a thing of Pepsi might cost at a basketball game in 2 months' time.
No, look, I take your point. And even Jamie Dimon which Morgan is he? He's JP Morgan Chase, isn't he?
Yeah.
The arch capitalist, the boss of the biggest Wall Street bank, has said he no longer does he just follow the shareholder value mantra. Where in his decisions as CEO, he serves, I think he says there's five stakeholders he serves. The shareholders are one of them. It's staff, it's the wider community, it's your suppliers, and one other. But yeah, even Jamie Dimon kind of agrees with you that we've gone beyond, it's only about the shareholders, but it's still a bit about the shareholders.
It's a tiny bit.
Not a tiny bit.
I've got tech sort of ETFs in my portfolio, so you could argue that I am a Twitter shareholder. It's not, I mean, squeezy, but still, it's not, you're not there to provide returns for the shareholders at any cost to the company. You're not. I mean, you'll kill the goose that's laying the golden tweet, for starters. But it's just, that's not the point of being a shareholder. You've put some money in to help a company grow. That's what you've done as a shareholder.
I think you've been a bit idealistic.
I just think it's wrong.
There's still a fiduciary duty to shareholders. If you work for this company,
but not,
you've got a fiduciary duty to Dubai Holding and the owners of that company to make them, to generate returns for them. You do, as an employee.
Yeah, but I don't get to murder you and bury you in a broom cupboard as be like, well, it's just better for the shareholders, isn't it? If there's no Richard Dean, we'll just take him out.
Yeah, but by the same token, if you know, we're a radio station, we survive on advertising, you can't go, I don't like adverts. I'm going to get rid of all of those because I don't like them.
No, but this is not that.
Dubai Holding shareholders would not be happy. And they would have a point.
Twitter also has a duty to its users. It has a duty to its employees. It has a duty to the business as a whole. And it has a duty to the platform. It doesn't only have a duty to the shareholders.
Yeah, I agree. I guess the question is not, do we agree or disagree in principle? I agree that it does serve multiple stakeholders. But what's the weighting we attach to each of those? The customers, the staff, the wider community, the environment and shareholders. Yeah, I mean, it's a parlor game. It's a thought experiment. I don't know. I don't have an answer. But maybe this will be a test case for that.
But let us see what happens next. And given that it is Elon Musk, there will be a next, won't there? And then a next after that, and a next after that, and a next after that.
Talking of billionaires, I've been looking at Vijay Mallya, Financial Times this morning, reporting that he's been jailed for 4 months in India. Now, in some ways, it's a token gesture because he's been in the United Kingdom for about 5 years now and is fighting extradition back to India. But he has been jailed for 4 months, all due to debts of $1 billion or more related to the collapse of his airline, Kingfisher, several years ago in India. I'm going to get Shruti Rajendran's take on this in a second. But first of all, this is he, Vijay Mallya. He was featured in a Netflix documentary a couple of years ago that they called Bad Boy Billionaires. And they looked, and it was all Indian tycoons who had fallen on tough times. And this is a bit from that. First up, you'll hear Vijay Mallya himself speaking outside a court in London, trying to fight his extradition, and then a couple of commentators and critics of his.
The allegations are baseless, and you will see our submissions in court. I will not allow you to make any sort of judgments based on my comments.
The only difference between a petty criminal and Vijay Mallya is that he wears the suits and throws lavish parties.
But that one airline, you just did him in. If that hadn't gone wrong, Vijay would have been king till today. Everybody would have been bowing down and touching his feet, even now.
Very quickly, Shruti, for those who don't know Vijay Mallya, who is he? What's the 30-second version of who he is?
Well, he's at one point a celebrated Indian businessman. He was also a former member of the parliament in India, Rajya Sabha. And he created Kingfisher Airlines, which at one point had the second largest share of domestic air travel in India. And then just things went wrong. And now he is fighting extradition from the UK.
He is indeed. I met him once. And interviewed him at the Dubai Air Show when Kingfisher Airlines was still a going concern. He remains to this day the only executive when I said, Mr. Mallya, can I get a quick interview with you after the press conference? He said, yes, but only if we do it in the bar. Because, of course, he made his fortune in the beverage industry, yes. First of all. And that went well. Airlines, not so much.
This is the Bite Size Business Breakfast, exclusively on DubaiEye1038.com.
Let's look into the big economic story this week here in the region. It is the visit of President Joe Biden to Israel, first of all, today, and then the West Bank, and then Saudi Arabia later on in the week. Joining us now on the line from Beirut, I'm delighted to say, is the former Lebanese economy minister and the present president of Nasser Saeedi and Associates here in Dubai, Dr. Nasser Saeedi. Nasser, good morning. Nice speaking to you.
Good morning to you. Good morning to you.
So in terms of the economic agenda that Joe Biden has this week, you say the number one priority is oil and energy. Explain that.
Very clear. I mean, Biden is visiting at a time at which oil prices are at a high, albeit they've come down a little bit from the 120, 130 that we've seen, but still averaging $100. Inflation in the U.S. is running at around 9%. There is looming recession, certainly in Europe and maybe the U.S. And that is the background to his visit. So what he'd like to achieve, of course, is to have the Saudis on board and perhaps the other GCC countries, particularly UAE, to pump more oil. I mean, that's certainly his objective. Whether that will be successful is another issue, because Saudi and the other GCC countries would like to see what does the U.S. have to offer. They are requesting more oil pumping, but what do the GCC countries get in return for that? So those are the main issues facing Biden as he comes to the region. Does he have anything new to offer? He wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post talking about a vital leadership role in the region. But by and large, the Biden administration has been absent in the past 2 years. So that's the background, really, to the visit.
Okay, well, that's interesting. And the oil economic story will play out on Friday, and we'll see what he can negotiate with the UAE and Saudi Arabia, really the only two countries, we think, with significant spare capacity. I'm interested in the economics in the region where you are. You're in Beirut this morning, Dr. Nasser. He's going to Israel, first of all, and then the West Bank. And the stark contrast in the economies of those two areas is breathtaking, really. I was looking at the GDP figures this morning. Israel, GDP per capita of about $45,000. Palestine or the West Bank, GDP per capita of about $4,000. And I was there a few weeks ago. You can see it when you're there, when you cross between the two. What economically could he do for Palestine?
Well, he's unlikely to be proposing anything such as a two-state solution or proposing any grand schemes to help the Palestinians. At best, he might reverse some of the Trump administration decisions, such as, for example, Trump had removed some $100 million on aid, particularly for Palestinians in the territories that could not obtain such health services locally. But I don't see any grand schemes coming out of it. Nothing about the two-state solution, nothing about any economic initiatives that the United States might take towards Israel and the Palestinians. So it is a bit of a moot visit. He has to go through Israel on his way to Saudi. And by the way, it's the first time an American president actually flies direct from Israel to Saudi Arabia. But there's nothing else. I mean, we haven't heard anything from the Americans in terms of an economic agenda, either for the region or for Israel, Palestine.
What about the country where you're located, Dr. Nasser? We've spoken many times about the challenges economically that Lebanon is facing at the moment, and that's to put it mildly. What's the situation on the ground there at the moment, and what, if anything, could the United States do to help?
Well, the United States could very clearly tell the caretaker Miati government to start negotiating in full and good faith with the IMF. There is an initial staff-level agreement with the IMF. There are some clear reforms that are required. The United States should send a very clear message. Stop dilly-dallying. Stop wasting time. Get on with the reforms. And we are willing to support you, along with the Europeans, the IMF, World Bank, and other international countries, as well as with the GCC. We haven't heard that yet. Again, this visit might be like a missed opportunity to address a number of issues facing the region. And we know there are other issues such as the role of Iran, etc., that the GCC countries will want to hear about. So it's not clear what the agenda is beyond trying to nudge the GCC countries, UAE and Saudi, to pump more oil. But even if you go back to the oil question, is there sufficient refining capacity? Saudi and the UAE could pump more oil, but does the rest of the world have the refining capacity? That's not clear either.
Dr. Saeedi, finally, the situation on the ground in Lebanon where you are at the moment, it has been very severe. I'm looking at the exchange rate, the Lebanese pound against the US dollar. Yes. It's been quoted at around about $30,000 right now. Of course, the official rate is much lower than that. What are you seeing on the ground? We've got about a minute left.
Well, continuing misery. There are shortages, but people's access to basic services, health, education, all the rest has been severely impaired. Poverty is now reaching 80% of the Lebanese population, and there's nothing in sight to say that this will be addressed very soon. So all I can see is continuing inflation, and there is talk now of adjusting salaries in the public sector, starting with judges. Once you start doing that, i.e. increasing salaries without additional revenues, what you're talking about is a scenario of hyperinflation. And unfortunately, that's what I'm looking at the moment, sitting here in Beirut. More misery, continued reduction in per capita GDP, but a situation reaching hyperinflation, I'm sorry to say.
Dr. Saeedi, you're always candid and we appreciate that. Thanks very much indeed for your time this morning. Dr. Nasser Saeedi from Nasser Saeedi & Associates, based here in Dubai, currently in Beirut, and of course the former economy minister in Lebanon.
Catch up on the business headlines with the Bite-sized Business Breakfast.
Where we are this morning, looking at one of our and indeed everyone's top stories, Heathrow telling airlines to stop selling summer tickets as it imposes its first ever cap on departing passengers out of the airport. What does it mean for your summer travel plans? Very pleased to be joined by Nick Humphrey, aviation expert and partner at the law firm Kennedy's. Nick, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Brandy.
Right, context very quickly. How bad are things that Heathrow has to do this?
Look, it's contextually, it gets the headlines, but it's not as bad as it seems. I'm going to sort of, you know, dilute this story a little bit. Currently, there's scheduled to be 104,000 passengers per day to travel out of Heathrow. Now, under this reduction, it goes down to 100,000, which is 4,000 seats that are affected. Now, currently, of those 4,000, 1,500 have been sold. So this only really affects, I think it's 10 flights a day. It might be a few less. In context, so that's 600 over this two-month period, out of which there's 70,000 flights. So there's 600 flights affected out of 70,000. Now, it's obviously bad press because Heathrow is a significant airport. It's a significant airport, particularly for travellers from the UAE who will be travelling there on holidays. But I guess I'll give another context as well. Of the top 10 worst airports in Europe, Heathrow doesn't feature. It's number 15 in the list, in the all-star list. Now, if you're travelling to Brussels Airport, good luck. 72% delay. And then Frankfurt, which ranks second, it's had 7.8% cancellations. So contextually, Heathrow, you know, it's not good. There's been threats by one of the ground handling organisations, Swissport, that they might sue them over this because they have staffed up. Now, I think it's going to be a challenge how you demonstrate the damages if it's only really affecting 10 flights a day and whether they affect all of Swissport's flights. We know Dubai's Danata has got significant operations at Heathrow as well. So in the scheme of things, it's not as bad as it sounds. However, of those, let's say, 100,000 passengers that are passing through Heathrow every day, I don't think it's going to be a lot of fun. So, you know, there's still going to be delays. People are still going to be affected. There's still going to be, you know, long queues, delays at security, delays at check-in, lost baggage. And that's one of the things. I think there's been some bad press with Heathrow of pictures of mounds of luggage that has lost their owners. And also the biggest issue, it seems, is security.
I hear what you're saying in terms of we're talking, as you say, 4,000 tickets, less than sort of 3% of what is scheduled each day. However, the concern is what is going to be cancelled. If airlines can't sell more seats on flights, could they be cancelling whole flights themselves? How will this actually play out in practice?
Well, it's actually not clear of who gets cancelled. So whether it's a lotto or not, that's quite unclear. And the clarity on the flights, because there's some airlines which have still been operating what we'll call ghost flights, because Heathrow have got the protective slots, which they hadn't alleviated that position at all. So this will be a relief to some airlines that are travelling still with low capacity. However, how and who gets cancelled, it's unclear from the information. And I guess the other thing is that the airlines aren't happy about this. The airlines have been telling Heathrow, this is our schedule, we've got lots of demand, demand's coming up in summer. And Heathrow had to revise their scheduled numbers on a number of occasions, not seeming to talk to their main users of the airport, being the airlines. So there seems to be a number of fundamental issues. Mixed with this, and I guess some good news, is that it seems that the BA check-in staff strike looks like it'll be alleviated as well. So it looks like they'll crack a deal today.
Could this potentially cause problems for other UK airports? People, as you say, see this headline, they think, oh, I'm not going to be able to fly out of Heathrow. They start booking tickets for Gatwick, for Stansted, and it has a domino effect.
Yeah. Well, funny you mentioned Gatwick, because Gatwick does feature in Europe's top 10 worst airports. So it's experiencing a lot worse delay and cancellations than even Heathrow is. And also Luton Airport is having a number of issues. So this does have a massive flow-on effect, not just the UK airports where people are looking up for alternative exit points, but also where there's a delay at one airport and you're flying to another, that ends up causing, you know, these are network issues. So it doesn't just affect one area. And if you look across Europe, there's issues in the Netherlands, in France, in Italy. And of all things, it seems that the Spanish airports seem to be featuring in the top 10 best. So if that's a place to go, look at Spain.
Wild speculation time. As you said, we don't know which airlines and how this is all going to be divided up. But obviously, the Dubai to London route is a major one.
Mm. Yes, it is. And I guess the thing is, you've got large wide-body aircraft with large amounts of passengers flying in on these aircraft, as distinct from some of the regional carriers, which have got 200-300 people. You know, you've got Emirates flying an A380, which might have 600 people. So you do question, but, you know, I think it'll all be about arrival times and those peak arrival times and you know, flattening out the curve at those peak arrival times.
Could there, 30 seconds, be knock-on effects for DXB, for AUH, with connecting flights coming from Heathrow into here that just aren't?
Definitely that's going to cause a lot of connectivity issues. And if we consider through the summer period, it's going to be a bit of a challenge. But then also we get into that bridging season of fog. We then get into a World Cup situation where you've got, you know, Fly Dubai, for example, flying, what is it? Is it 30 or 40 flights a day? So there's going to be a lot of structural challenges over the next 3 to 6 months.
And Nick Humphrey, aviation expert and partner at the law firm Kennedy's, putting in context for us that big headline of the morning, Heathrow asking airlines to stop selling summer tickets, imposing its first ever cap on the number of passengers that can fly out from the airport during summer.
Just the highlights. This is the Bite-Sized Business Breakfast.
Well, we're looking at the currency markets and their implications for holidays.
Holiday.
And that is because the strong dollar and dirham, particularly against the euro, are great news if you're going on holiday to Germany this year. However, if you're a German tourist booking your winter holiday here in Dubai or the rest of the region, that makes it very, very expensive. What impact is it actually happening on the ground? Delighted to welcome into the studio the Vice President for Deutsche Hospitality here in Dubai. He is Siegfried Nierhaus, and he's a veteran of Dubai's hotel industry. Siegfried, good morning. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Richard.
Deutsche Hospitality, Andy. Not a household name. You're best known for brands like Steigenberger and Intercity, which you have or have had in the UAE over the past few years. So, in very simple terms, almost at parity euro-dollar, what impact is that having on bookings going forward from Europe?
Good point. I think this the change happened just not now, right? The euro has been on top, I think it's 2008, at 1.6 versus the euro, versus the dollar, sorry. It has seen, since the beginning, a 12% drop. Yes, it has significant impact on how do you distribute your expenses from a European perspective. And yes, the travel habits will change. The travel habit will be different. People will prefer to go to Europe currency countries. But nevertheless, I think UAE's destination has offer and has to offer such a diverse offer in terms of pricing as well, which makes the destination still very, very attractive. And in addition to that, if you see what happened in Europe, and I've listened to your show, when you hear about all the challenges, all the service challenges that Europe is facing in the tourism industry, does it come to hotels which seeing a hike in occupancy and they cannot cope with the service? When it comes to the airline industry, I think Dubai can offer much more of this. And I think the comfort of guests and customer coming to the destination will be more important than this 12% drop in the Europe versus the dollar. So I think the impact is there, but not as big as everyone is expecting.
So what are you doing in terms of pricing when you're selling to guests coming out of Europe? You've got a Steigenberger hotel in Doha, for example. Big year for them with the World Cup coming up, as well as having intercity hotels here in Dubai. You've also got, you're involved in properties in Ras Al Khaimah as well, in Al Hamra, which are very much a tourist destination and very popular with European travellers. Are you having to adjust your packages and your rates for European travellers? Are you working with, for example, tour operators in the likes of Germany and France and other key source markets to try and tweak the package to make it more affordable?
Yes, we are listening. Yes, we have learned all to be super adaptable and flexible when it comes to the past 2 years where we have seen heights of all kind of challenges. So yes, we adapt our prices. We work with tour operators from Germany, from France. They are raising up their concerns. We try to compensate in terms of additional services as well, not necessarily to touch on the price, because the prices are more or less fixed for a season, right? So this fluctuation which could happen, we try to compensate with additional services. But nevertheless,
such as what? So what would you throw in to sweeten the deal?
You see, some destination has become almost this the new way of doing in the UAE, which is the all-inclusive thing, right? So the all-inclusive, which has been developed in some parts of the UAE and has been very popular, you can add different packages to that, right? You have then three different levels of packages and you add a superior level, which is attractive to clients. And you know how much the Germans are liking this kind of business and this kind of way of traveling. So yes, we have been successful with that kind of thing. And then you add additional experiences that you can do in the UAE, right? The UAE has developed such a great offer in terms of diversification of tourist attraction, where you can add some pluses into your offer.
The all-inclusive model is interesting. I'm sure you've looked at the economics very, very closely and how to make it work. Obviously, there'll be a few people who don't abuse it because it's all-inclusive and it's all you can eat and drink, but people who really go to town at the buffet and whatever else may be, the F and the B. How do you manage that?
True. It's a challenge. It's a challenge, especially if you see that all the prices are increasing, right? And not only the energy price, it's not only the oil price, but it is as well the food price, right? Which you see, which is increasing. So yes, you have to adapt the food items that you are proposing, right? Still focusing on quality, but you have different ways of sourcing these. And of course, some hotels and some properties, and you see the trend, are limiting the all-inclusive offer sometimes, right? Not having all-inclusive, all what you can drink, it will be some limited offers, which you start implementing, because this is the global trend is that. Recently you have seen the Spain is implementing that from a government, from a law perspective, that the all-inclusive is not anymore this all-inclusive, and you have limited number of drinks which are offered for the meal periods, and we are doing the same trend.
More broadly, what are you planning for this region going forward? Deutsche Hospitality has 8 brands in total. We mentioned a couple of them there. Intercity, which is it fair to say a more affordable brand?
Correct. It's a mid-market brand. We call it a mid-market 3 to 4 star brand, yes.
And Steigenberger, which is a...
Which is our 5-star brand, right? So we offer different 8 different brands from different coming from economy lifestyle to luxury. The Steigenberger is our flagship brand. Going forward, we have 3 other hotels to open in the destination this year.
So it's in the UAE.
In the UAE, no, we have the Hasselheimer properties, which opened the Alhambra Village, the Alhambra Residence, hugely popular. Very happy to have that in our portfolio. And of course, for us, the big thing is the World Cup, where we not only hope to be super successful with our Steigenberger Hotel and residence in Doha, but as well, I'm sure the German soccer team will do very well in Doha.
Oh, well, as a proud England soccer fan, this conversation could go on for hours and hours and hours.
Could go. Time will tell, but we are very confident, Richard.
Look forward to that one very much indeed, Siegfried. Great talking to you. Appreciate you joining us in the studio this morning and getting up early.
Pleasure.
That is the voice of Siegfried Nierhaus. He's with Deutsche Hospitality here in Dubai, looking at the impact of the strong dirham and the weak euro on hospitality here in the UAE.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.